The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to this Tuesday edition of The Dan Proft Show. Thanks for joining us. You can get podcasts of the program at danproftshow.com. Follow us on social media at Dan Proft Show. And we begin by updating the Fredo and Nipple Rings Gambino act. That's a great name for a hip-hop act. It turns out to be a terrible vaudeville act, though. And Chris Cuomo, Fredo, took to his show yesterday to explain why he won't be covering negative news about his brother, which distinguishes all previous coverage of his brother on his show. Here's Fredo.
Before we start tonight, let me say something that I'm sure is very obvious to you who watch my show. And thank you for that. You're straight with me, I'll be straight with you. Obviously, I'm aware of what's going on with my brother. And obviously, I cannot cover it because he is my brother. Now, of course, CNN has to cover it. They have covered it extensively, and they will continue to do so. I have always cared very deeply about these issues, and profoundly so. I just wanted to tell you that. There's a lot of news going on that matters also, so let's get after that.
Translation, obviously I cannot cover negative news about my brother, unlike obviously I could use my show and CNN to lionize my brother's handling of COVID, play Q-tip grab ass with him, help him sell books, discuss his POTUS ambitions, and yuck it up about his dating life. That old swordsman, him. Yeah, obviously. By the way, can you get this Yale graduate a thesaurus so he uses an adverb other than obviously? This was Chris Cuomo, just to remind anybody who's forgotten, share it with your friends. Chris and Andy, Fredo and Nipples Ring Gambino, back in June in better times.
I just hope you recognize what even I'm able to recognize, being spawned from the same wolf pack. I hope you are able to appreciate what you did in your state and what it means for the rest of the country now and what it will always mean to those who love and care about you the most. I'm wowed by what you did, and more importantly, I'm wowed by how you did it. This was very hard. I know it's not over, but obviously I love you as a brother. Obviously, I'll never be objective. Obviously, I think you're the best politician in the country. But I hope you feel good about what you did for your people, because I know they appreciate it. Nothing's perfect. You'll have your critics.
Thank you.
But I've never seen anything like what you did, That's why I'm so happy to have had you on the show, and I hope you know that.
I think he does, obviously. Nipples Ring Gambino in better times, you know, hey, he just does what's right and lets the chips fall where they may.
So you just do what's right. I did what was right. I'm comfortable with what I did. I think the facts bear it out. I think the numbers bear it out. I think we saved tens of thousands of lives, but I did what was right.
That's what he does. He does what's right. Against that backdrop, the number of individuals in his party's ranks, his fellow travelers calling for his resignation, is increasing with each passing day as the number of accusers, female accusers, increase with each passing day. Yesterday, a third woman coming forward to accuse Cuomo of inappropriate sexual behavior, saying he grabbed and kissed her at a wedding 2 years ago in 2019. This 33-year-old said he started by coming up to her. She doesn't know him. This is her story. Puts his hand on the small of her back at a wedding. She pushes his hand away. That's got to be a sort of a daunting thing to do for the governor. But nonetheless, if what she's saying is accurate, good for her. And then he said, and there's pictures of this. In fact, it's the picture that adorns the New York Post with the headline Handsy Andsy, because Randy Andy was taken. He grabs her cheeks. He grabs her by the cheeks, puts his hands on her two cheeks, and tries to kiss her. she recounts this saying, I turned my head and apparently, according to my friend, he kissed me on the cheek. Mm-hmm. I guess she just doesn't understand his madcap humor. Because remember, that was the standing explanation, the standing apology as of yesterday when it was just two accusers. It's just, he's just got a zany sense of humor. He likes to kid around with people he works with and who work for him. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something about this crude, licentious, but there's something else too. These cosmopolitan Pauls, aren't they just so lame with his fifth grade playground rap? It's just remarkable. Now, the interesting thing is the timing of this. A lot of people have raised that. Why go after Cuomo now? These mostly, the last two women who've come forward are new, but certainly the first woman who came forward who worked for him, Boylan, she made these accusations last year. The questions and indication that the public was being lied to by the Cuomo administration about deaths at nursing homes was something that was raised last year, reported on last year. Why the feeding frenzy now with Mayor Warren Wilhelm throwing in, with the first member of New York's congressional delegation, a Democrat, Kathleen Rice, throwing in saying he should resign? Why now? For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined again by Adam Mill. He is an attorney specializing in labor and employment and public administration law. He's also a contributor to The Federalist, Am Greatness, American Greatness, and The Daily Caller. Adam, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Oh, Dan, thank you so much, and thank you for all that you do.
I liked your piece, and I want to get to the gist of it. But just first with what you see going right now, the besieged Cuomo, you know, his political aspirations now done. Now he's in strict survival mode. But the walls are closing in on him now when much of this has been known for some time. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, when you were playing that clip of his brother saying, you know, that CNN has to cover the news about him. And I was thinking to myself, news is probably the wrong word because news implies new, doesn't it? We've known since almost right away that his nursing home executive order was just a disaster. And I mean, you can go all the way back. He commissioned a report that was ghostwritten by the McKinsey Consulting Group. And it said that none of these excess nursing home deaths were his fault. So what happened, just to remind the readers, is that right after COVID hit, I mean, this is really early on, I'm talking like February or March of last year, Cuomo signed an executive order, one, banning hydrochloroquine as a therapy, which was a strange thing to do right off the bat. And then the other thing he did was he forced nursing homes to accept COVID patients back into their, or he banned the fact that they had COVID as a reason to get rid of them. And then the result was predictable. And so you've got thousands of people in New York, and it's not just New York, New Jersey, Michigan, I think Pennsylvania are the four states where they did this. Thousands of families who lost their elderly mothers and fathers, who weren't able to go to a funeral, who weren't able to visit them while they were sick. They died in a lockdown, basically a bedroom that was turned into a cell, a horrible, lonely death for somebody that you love. And it was because Cuomo did not shelter the nursing homes. There were thousands of excess deaths. And one of the other things that he did, and this was known too, I mean, I knew about this, you know, months ago, was that if it looked like a COVID nursing home patient was about to die, he would make sure that the nursing home got that person into the hospital, and then that person would not be counted as a nursing home death of COVID. But even with that policy, thousands of elderly people still died in those nursing homes. And these sexual harassment claims, as you said, they've been around for a while. The Guardian reported on one of them last, I think, December. He's also had other problems with people who worked for him, you know, being caught taking a bribe.
Do you think this is just essentially critical mass of all the people that he's crossed, angered, all of the bad acts? It just piled up and it reached critical mass at this point in time, or there's something else afoot with respect to the timing of this?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what they want you to think. Like it's a water clock with like a jug of water, you know, dripping into it. When it reaches a certain weight, then it, you know, throws a switch and then it's a critical mass. I don't think that's true at all. I mean, I think we know from history that there's all different masses of scandals that affect different players. So, you know, for Al Franken, it was that one picture. For Harvey Weinstein, it took years of raping people before something finally happened. Cuomo, you know, it's, I don't think it's a critical mass. I think that the Democrats are doing what any kind of unified, all-powerful party does, which is the power game happens internally. And I think somebody's looking at Cuomo and deciding that he's in the way. They don't need him anymore. Big Bad Orange is gone. And so the political winds have shifted. He's not valuable anymore. And somebody wants that governor position, and he's sitting in it.
Somebody might be Tish James, but I let's pick it up after the break. I want to get your take on who that somebody might be, and maybe somebody who also doesn't want him trying to trying to springboard up to the national stage as well, which speaks to this piece and that you've penned in terms of what you think the Cuomo demise may be a dress rehearsal for. More with Adam Mill. He is an attorney specializing in labor and employment law, and a contributor to the Federalist, American Greatness, and Daily Caller. We'll be right back.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. We're speaking with Adam Mill. He's an attorney specializing in labor, employment, and public administration law, contributor to the Federalist, American Greatness, and the Daily Caller. And before the break, we were talking about the timing of the feeding frenzy that has enveloped Cuomo. It seems like this guy has fallen into his own piranha tank, as I've sort of characterized it previously. And, you know, why this is, and maybe somebody sees their opportunity to ascend to the governor's mansion. Maybe the attorney general, Tish James, who he actually made, ironically, but I'm sure that won't bother her. And maybe also there are parties at the national level who don't want Cuomo thinking about anything outside the corporate boundaries of New York. Your take on that, Adam?
Yeah, and I think that you mentioned the attorney general from New York. Kamala Harris is another person that's suspected. You know, the Biden administration has commented on this and said that you know, they believe his accusers. And it's, yeah, I think sexual harassment is a, you know, it's a very serious thing. It needs to be taken seriously. But it's astonishing to me that it's weighing heavier than these nursing home deaths and, you know, these people dying these horrible deaths. But I guess that's the culture we live in. You know, so I think that another thing is if you're on the inside of this kind of leftist, you know, monolith, you should be worried because they can turn on you. Your purity doesn't matter. Your, you know, how much you've played ball doesn't matter. If you get in the way, they can turn on you. And it comes out as a coordinated effort with the press. You know, the FBI opened up investigations. The U.S. attorney opened up an investigation and made all this public. And it all just kind of rolled out all at once. It was almost like an anti-Donald Trump movement.
So is this, you know, why? I mean, so I understand it's a viper pit. I think most people get that. You know, everybody's seen House of Cards, at least the American version. They should see the British version with Ian Richardson as Francis Urquhart, but I digress. So who here wants to sideline Andrew Cuomo, doesn't want him recovering and being relevant in 2024? Would that be sort of Kamala Harris and Joe Obama world, or is this really a parochial matter in New York State?
It's hard for me to say. And I mean, there are other things that could be going on too, like business interests in New York maybe don't like the way he's been managing you know, legislation through Albany and what he's approving of and what he's not approving of. It could be a, you know, regulation thing. It could be just a convergence of several things all at once. I wish I, you know.
Yeah,
no,
I mean, it's speculative.
So I don't know. But what you can see very clearly is this is not just a, you know, an organic thing. This is all happening, you know, with a single kind of decision being made behind the scenes, because it's just so coordinated and all the talking points all line up. It's like what used to happen to Trump. And it's a great lesson for the left that, you know, all that stuff you thought was great when it was going against Big Bad Orange, those guns can be turned back inward and pointed at you.
You,
want to,
Yeah, right. I mean, right, sure. I mean, these identitarians, cannibalizing one another is just another day at the office. There's no question. With respect to this piece that you wrote for amgreatness.com, another angle you have here is a suggestion that what we see playing out with Andrew Cuomo could be a dress rehearsal for what plays out with Joe Biden. Elaborate on that theory.
Yeah, I've written on this before. When you look at the things that were run against Donald Trump, the investigation for foreign entanglements, election shenanigans, and past sexual harassment allegations, and at one point in time his competency, all of those tactics could easily be applied to the current president, to President Joe Biden. And there's already been some steps taken. I mean, you look at the fact that the Democrats, his own Democrats, are talking about trying to take away his power to launch nuclear weapons as the elected president of the United States, which, first of all, that's got huge constitutional implications if they were to do that. But it is a hint that they've already decided that his mental acuity is not there and he can no longer be trusted with the nuclear weapon. So it does look like the first moves are being made. Is it a warning to get him under control, or are they serious and they want to take the next step, elevate Kamala Harris, and move forward with something everyone was probably expecting sooner or later, but sooner rather than later?
Well, so it's one of those things, too, where not only the mental acuity question, but just his penchant for going whichever way the wind is blowing and his collegiality with some of the old timers in the Senate and so forth, he could be led astray to do something less radical than the Marxist left that dominates the Democrat Socialist Party wants to do. And this is a way to essentially keep him in line, is to say, if you don't toe this line, our line, then, we'll undermine you in this way. And of course, we have all of these examples and anecdotes and an accuser like Tara Reid, who those examples and anecdotes and accusers were all shunted aside during the campaign, but we can bring them all back and probably find some more and do to you what is being done to Andrew Cuomo right now to usher you out before your term is up.
That's exactly right. And that's exactly why I wrote the title of the article, which is President Biden better pay attention to what's happening to Cuomo, because it, whether intentionally or not, it is a warning that he is vulnerable to that same kind of turning on a dime and yesterday's friends are today's enemies. Biden is so vulnerable to all of that.
And I don't find Kamala Harris like particularly sharp, but I do find her particularly conniving. And that Cheshire cat grin she's always got on her face, I would think, boy, I would sleep with one eye open if I was Joe Biden.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there are a lot of banana peels laying around in the White House right now.
it would be interesting, too, thinking about this just even in the shorter term than even his first term, 4 years, thinking about this from a midterm perspective. What happens if they lose control of the House and or Senate? Does that expand Biden's shelf life or contract it?
I think that if they lose control after the midterms, Biden becomes, unless he develops some new vigor and vim and announces that he's going to definitely run at the end of 4 years, he's an irrelevant lame duck after that. So he's particularly expendable after the midterms. I think one difference between our side and the other side is that we can look at the situation with Cuomo. We can not like Cuomo, but still say this is bad. He's being treated unfairly. He's, this is being brought up in a coordinated effort to take him down. It should have been handled as the facts were unfolding rather than holding it as ammunition for political timing. I'm against that, whether it's happening to Cuomo, whether it's happening to Trump, regardless of who it's happening to. This is very cynical politics.
Andrew Cuomo is the kind of guy that the word Schadenfreude was invented to apply to. But I hear what you're saying. I mean, I think he deserves what he's getting, but your point is well taken that not in the way he's getting it. It should have, as you say, handled at the time of these offenses were that occurred and or were uncovered or should have been uncovered. That's a fair point. He is Adam Mill. He's an attorney specializing in labor and employment, as well as public administration law. Contributor to The Federalist, Am Greatness, American Greatness, and The Daily Caller. Do check out his piece, which I'll tweet out, is Cuomo's Destruction, a Dress Rehearsal for Biden. Adam, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. Switching gears, going to Evanston, Illinois, where I lived for a few years when I was an undergrad at Northwestern University. Making news, national news, becoming the first city in America to actually set up a reparations fund for its black residents. This was profiled on Good Morning America. And, oh, by the way, it was interesting, too, as a quick aside, I noted that former President Obama was asked about reparations in a podcast he did with that deep thinker Bruce Springsteen, and said, oh, he met white resistance to reparations during his time as president. Really? Met white resistance. So you were a supporter of reparations. That's something you wanted to do. You just met white resistance. You're president of the United States. Could have pushed through that white resistance, couldn't you have? I would think. I would think that most of the white leftists that populated his administration would have been on board. Legislative leaders? Dems? Really? It hadn't ripened yet? Well, why not use your bully pulpit to make the case then, if this was something that was on your agenda? Or is it more likely that, being the intellectual lightweight that he is, the celebutant that he is and always was, that he is just trying to remain au courant and rewrite history so he can be down with the struggle of Black Lives Matter and his fellow Marxists in the present tense? Back to Evanston. The program they set up, $10 million fund, $1 million a year, funded by sales tax on marijuana, which, according to Evanston elders, whites and blacks purchase in roughly equal amounts, and so it's equitable, the funding source, although certainly curious, sort of like gambling to fund schools. That money will be used to dole out $25,000 housing grants to eligible Evanston residents. Here is the architect of this reparations plan, an alderman in the city of Evanston named Robin Rue Simmons, giving the background to Good Morning America.
This is my home. It's where I live. I love it. My people are here. This community was redlined historically, and that has come along with damages that continue today. Resources were stripped away from the black community, and that stripped away a sense of place and wealth as well.
We've been doing the work, and the work that we've done has not produced any relief in the racial disparities that we have. And it was appropriate that we do something radically different to make good on the commitment that we've made to the black community. And reparations was the next thing for us to do.
Oh, yeah, obviously.
When I introduced reparations in Evanston, it was always the first step of many to come. There is a lifetime of work ahead of me and my children for us to get to justice for the black community. And I can't wait to celebrate the family that receives their first reparation benefit. I cannot wait for that day.
Mm-hmm. This is going to be something that promotes equity, meaning equality of outcomes, not equality of opportunity, and racial harmony, do you think? That's what the sales pitch is, isn't it? So there's the predicate question of, is this a good idea? And then there's the secondary questions about a $25,000 housing grant in a city that's median home price is about $450,000. Can you come up with 20% down? because that has nothing to do with redlining these days, does it? Can you maintain the payments on homes like that, or are you going to also sort of be continue to be de facto segregated in the western part of Evanston, where most of the black residents are located? The segregation, de facto segregation, no longer under color of law, but the de facto segregation that exists in so many cities, ironically, so many cities lorded over by Democrats, like Evanston has been from time immemorial. All of this injustice that occurred in Evanston throughout its history, like America's history, there's no question that racism existed. There's no question there were racist laws and racist cultural norms and racist policies. And Evanston has been dominated by the left for as long as I've been alive. So it's a bit of a struggle here to square exactly the argument that's being made about what has or has not changed, and thus what does or does not need to be remedied. And we'll pick up that conversation right after this. I'll stop the world at melt with you. You've seen the difference, and it's getting better all the time. The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show. Welcome back to the show. We were talking about the reparations program that has been launched in Evanston, Illinois, and this argument that is made by proponents of reparations and just the race hustle generally. On the one hand, we still live in systemically racist America, these systemically racist communities where blacks are systemically discriminated against, even in Evanston, Illinois. But on the other hand, those in charge are part of the solution. So this is where I have a little time following the logic. Are things still the way they were in 1963 Selma? In 2021 Evanston? If they're not, tell us what's changed. And tell us why you persist on suggesting that 2021 Evanston is 1963 Selma. And to the extent that it is, that you want to take the alternative view that it is, then, well, who's been in charge since 1963 in Evanston or Chicago or New York or, for the most part, L.A. or most of the major cities in America that are dominated by Democrats? I mean, you can't have it both ways. You're, on the one hand, we have this systematic problem in present. On the other hand, you and your fellow travelers have lorded over these places that you say are systemically problematic. Maybe we should change out the leadership then, if we've got the systemic problems, problem that persists. In addition to that alderman you heard from, who was the architect of this reparations program in Evanston, wanted you to hear from one of the Evanston residents that was interviewed by Good Morning America for this piece. He's a 98-year-old Evanston resident, a gentleman named Benjamin Gaines Sr. He's been in Evanston since 1959. That's when he settled in Evanston. Here's what he had to say about the reparations proposal and the state of Evanston.
The contractor, he said, so it's completely out. He said, you find a lot anywhere in Evanston, and I'll build whatever you want.
Well, when he said that, he men in the black neighborhoods. It was just the way it was. And as we speak, in 2021, we still have these same types of problems.
You have denied me all my 98 years.
Hopefully, before I die, I'll see the world change.
And get some reparations.
And get some reparations, right.
Yeah, I'm not so sure what a $25,000 housing grant will mean for Mr. Gaines, but the larger problem, with all due respect to what he said, is these problems persist. There's the argument I mentioned. Okay, well, these problems persist under who? Under the socialists that have lorded over Evanston since I've been alive? Chicagoland since I've been alive? Illinois for most of the time I've been alive? And half, that would be about half the life of Mr. Gaines. And my 98 years, hopefully I'll live long enough to see something change. I mean, again, respectfully, you haven't seen anything change in 98 years? To the extent you haven't, does that speak to what has or has not changed in America, or maybe what has or has not changed in the neighborhood in Evanston in which you live? But even I doubt even that. I mean, 98 years and the argument is nothing has changed in America? Come on. Well, that's just not the case, clearly. So why cling to that narrative? Because it's required in order to make the case for reparations, isn't it? We were treated shabbily for a long time ago, and nothing has changed, and so and nothing will change until we're conferred more. And so that's the posture we're going to take. Now contrast that with, say, Star Parker, who went from welfare to success as a single mom. She's black female. She wrote over at the Daily Signal on the topic of reparations. My ancestors were slaves, and my life as a young woman was a mess. Was my life a mess because my ancestors were slaves? I don't think so. My life was a mess because I lived a wanton, irresponsible existence defined by promiscuity, petty crimes, and scamming the nation's well-meaning but totally confused welfare system to the greatest extent of my ability. Did I need reparations to turn things around for me? Certainly not. I needed a wake-up call, which, to my great gratitude, I got from a few church-going black Christians who told me the way I was living was unacceptable. I went to church, took back responsibility for my life, and turned my circumstances around. She adds, the problem with the idea of reparations is it redirects attention away from exactly where attention is needed, an individual's personal responsibility for their own unique lives. And, of course, Star Parker stuck the landing there, and I think she has a pretty compelling background to legitimize her viewpoint, make it pretty powerful. And it goes to something we talk about over and over and over again when it comes to the leftist race hustle, the identitarian politics of all of this. The removal of agency from the individual. You are not an individual. That's why, you know, words like individuals and personal are stripped from the lingo of the left. You are not an individual. You're a member of a group, of a collective. You don't have agency, and thus you're either a member of a group that's been oppressed or you're a member of a group that's been an oppressor. And that's where the analysis ends. Whites were oppressors once upon a time. You're white today. You're part of that group. Blacks were oppressed once upon a time. You're black today. You're part of that group. End of discussion. So it perpetuates what? Victimization and at least the argument of oppression. Well, you need the argument of oppression in order to make the case for victimization, don't you? And this is the path of political power. This is what Shelby Steele and Bob Woodson and so many others have talked about for the better part of a half century. And it persists. It actually doesn't just persist in its form. It changes and advances, as you see with Evanston launching a $10 million reparations program. And you can be sure that won't be the last city in America to do so. This is Dan Prof.
Podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
Welcome back to the show, and Dr. Seuss is the latest to be felled by the purge, at least in part. But shouldn't it be in whole? Shouldn't it be in toto? Six, Dr. Seuss books will no longer be published because of racist and insensitive imagery, according to the racist and insensitive experts they retain to look at their books and make recommendations for the continued or discontinuation of the publication of these books. Six Dr. Seuss books. And to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street, If I Ran the Zoo, as well as McGillicutt's Pool, On Beyond Zebra, Scrambled Egg Super, and The Cat's Quizzer. Those are all gone. Dr. Seuss Enterprises listened to and took feedback from our audiences, including teachers, academics, specialists in the field. What field is that? As part of our review process. We then worked with a panel of experts, including educators, to review our catalog of titlogs and so on and so forth, and this is what they did. Mm-hmm. Passed over for Read Around America Day, which was originally essentially the working pay-on to the Dr. Seuss books. But here's the thing. If six books are bad, and some 60 books were written and illustrated by one Theodore Geisel, shouldn't they all have to go? Fruit of the Poisonous Tree, one might argue in a court of law, right? Theodore Geisel is a racist and an insensitive person and a hater and a misogynist, and he's anti-Asian, and he's all these other things. I mean, if you're going to take the reviews of the experts and the educators seriously, which I wouldn't, but apparently Dr. Seuss Enterprises did, shouldn't he go? Take him out of the California Hall of Fame. Take down any statues, references. He should be erased from our memory bank, shouldn't he? You know, the same way, oh, and by the way, this comes out of Loudoun County in part. Loudoun County Public Schools, one of the nation's most affluent schools, announced it will no longer recognize Dr. Seuss on his birthday because of the racial undertones of the book, not suitable for culturally responsive learning. Loudoun County, Virginia schools, that's where that one dad went off on the school board and said, figure it out how to open the schools or we'll replace you. Yeah, well, should replace him anyway. Read Across America Day, no more. Loudoun County School District, they're really taking a stand here. Yeah. But again, this needs to be categorical if we're serious about this. Or are you saying we shouldn't be serious about it? Root and branch, right? Same thing we need to do with Billy Shakespeare, with the schools that find that Shakespeare's works are promote toxic masculinity and white supremacy. Need to take his collected works, sonnets and all, to the bonfire, don't we? Or is it just we're not really supposed to take this seriously? At least not intellectually seriously. We're supposed to take it seriously with respect to the education of young people, the development of young people, but we're not supposed to take it serious intellectually. We're supposed to take it serious politically, and we're supposed to take it seriously in terms of educational impact, and we're supposed to take it seriously in terms of civilizational impact, but we're not supposed to take it seriously intellectually. Right. This is Dan Frost.
This is the Dan Proft Show. The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, the lockdown heroes and heroines that are no more. We talked earlier in the program about one Andrew Cuomo. How about the other side of the world in New Zealand? New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, she was celebrated early on in the pandemic as somebody who had gotten it right with the lockdowns. Well, now the headline at The Guardian is, everyone is angry, quote-unquote, Ardern under pressure over latest Auckland COVID lockdown. They're in their fourth lockdown, New Zealand. The city re-entered lockdown with level 3 restrictions in place for at least a week from Sunday following the discovery of a community case of unknown origin. One case lockdown. Snap 3-day lockdown that happened last month is happening again. And now the argument is whether or not to punish those who break lockdown protocols. Ardern saying at a press briefing yesterday, breaking the rules was unacceptable, and those that had done so were, quote, facing the full judgment of the entire nation. We're going to stick to shaming. But she argued against legal punishment for those breaking the particular lockdown protocols in the UK, you know, basically the shelter in place order and the like. And it just speaks to what many said at the outset of this, including epidemiologists like Sweden's Johan Giesecke, those who are, this is after we had gone into lockdown. He says, the thing about lockdown is once you set that precedent, once you get in, how do you get out? How do you get out? You set arbitrary thresholds? Or is it just flying by the seat of your pants with spike in cases or spike in hospitalizations? How big does the spike have to be and so on and so forth? And you're just forever playing lockdown whack-a-mole, which is what we've seen these lockdown heroes and heroines play, formerly heroes and heroines. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by Michael Hendricks. He's the Director of State and Local Policy at the Manhattan Institute. Michael, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's good to be with you.
Results, not headlines, is the title of your piece, and you are back over here in the States comparing and contrasting some states that made the decision to go with a lighter touch versus states that went into full lockdown and, as I was describing, played lockdown whack-a-mole for the better part of the last year.
That's right. I mean, while leaders in coastal hubs have been drawing headlines for their Cuomo press conferences and Newsom-like top-down leadership styles, heartland governors have been trusting their communities and letting locals lead. And that kind of smart, targeted approach, I think, really shows itself in the results. It shows itself in West Virginia, which has been leading the country in vaccinations. And it's been showing itself in places like Tennessee, where the governor of Tennessee, Bill Lee, has been saying, look, you can't say follow the science and close down our schools. We're going to give you the resources you need to educate our children. And that kind of smart, targeted leadership, I think, is really an example for the rest of the country. The media is just not paying attention to it.
Well, and it's sort of the reversal in rhetorical positioning in the new year also sort of speaks to what you're describing when Andrew Cuomo gives his State of the State address and he's talking about, you know, we need to get businesses back up and open. We can't wait for vaccinations. Everybody be vaccinated to reopen schools and these sorts of positions that were a virtual 180 from positions he had just a few weeks earlier, and consistent with what CDC has been saying, but they've been saying that since November. So the late adoption, but the adoption nonetheless of those positions that were actually being implemented by some of those heartland states you mentioned, seems to indicate as close as you'll get to an admission that they overreached.
Right. I think it's important to point out that in a place like California, that's prided itself in stringent lockdowns and mask mandates, that has not prevented the Golden State from experiencing a winter surge, becoming the first state to surpass 3 million cases. Things got so bad in January, I note this in the piece, that Southern California's air regulator suspended cremation limits to deal with a backlog of bodies from COVID-19. It's just unbelievable. So, you know, my sense is, like, now that the pandemic has dealt severely with every state in the country, we just should look at how individual states have actually performed on the metrics that matter. Are they vaccinating and are they educating? Because I think the lives of their residents depend on it.
Well, and are they growing? In other words, as you know, what does their business climate look like? Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, mentioning over the weekend, of course she did, that South Dakota has the lowest unemployment rate in the country. Florida, if you compare Florida and Ron DeSantis to, say, my home state of Illinois, Florida, which is a big, diverse state, bigger and just as diverse as Illinois, Florida has a case fatality rate that's 20% lower and an unemployment rate that's 30% lower than Illinois. And they, of course, Pritzker and DeSantis took two very different paths. So it's and then you go and look at, you know, the school openness metrics and you see the same thing, because Florida schools never really closed and Illinois schools did. And Chicago's just getting back up, opening in part at the grade school level now. And so you see it seems to me there's a real consistency. If you made that lockdown decision, you can predict the results that followed. And if you made that light touch decision, you can basically predict the results that followed across handling of COVID, handling the economy, handling of kids' education.
Well, and it's been amazing. You know, there were just forecasts of enormous budgetary and fiscal doom when the pandemic started for states and localities. You know, it's one of the reasons now why President Biden is proposing hundreds of billions, $350 billion to be specific, in flexible aid, meaning you can use that money almost however you like, for states and localities to help cover these budgetary shortfalls. And yet states around the country, many of whom have allowed their economies to flourish, are suddenly finding hundreds of millions of dollars into the cash cushion. You know, a place like Idaho is collecting more in tax revenues in the first three quarters of 2020 than in the first three quarters of 2020 than it did in the same period in 2019. And a state like Tennessee, which I mentioned earlier, in the first month, January of 2021, this year, it eclipsed its monthly tax revenue estimates by nearly $380 million, higher even than its take pre-pandemic in January. You know, now, of course, a state like Tennessee can propose renewed investments in education, broadband, healthcare, along with saving record amounts in the state's rainy day funds. So you just really have to ask, you know, are we rewarding bad behavior when we dole out billions of dollars as sort of a Biden bailout to states that already had, that already were fiscally profitable pre-pandemic, and that during the pandemic maybe did not lead in a smart, targeted way? Should we really be rewarding them?
Also, too, I mean, you know, another round of checks for, you know, Americans under 75 grand and 150 grand as a household, that sort of thing, too. We see, like you said, what was projected, what was anticipated, boy, more modeling that was wrong. And what the reality is with, say, median household incomes in a lot of these states has actually increased during the pandemic because of all the government funny money.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. For many Americans, by no means all, but for many Americans, they are better off now than they were even pre-pandemic. And almost entirely, it's because of incredible amounts of spending from the federal government. Now, in one sense, well, that's a relief, right? But on another sense, you know, for many, particularly in a place like New York, New York City, California, there's still incredible unemployment, and less reported is the underemployment. And that's not going away. So fine, we've cut checks. That's made an amazing difference to many people, also including state and local budgets, because you tax some of the spending that's occurred. But what happens afterward? You know, how are we going to make sure that the economies continue to come back and that there are actual jobs? You know, if you continue to pass regulation like they're doing in New York that prevents firms from hiring people, makes it much more difficult and then operate for businesses to stay alive and afloat, you know, there's still going to be this enormous amount of need. And yet the federal government would have blown through its debt barriers in a way that we've never seen before, and the money's just not going to be there. So the question is, how can we make sure that the regulatory environment's right, the economy's coming back, and the people are actually getting the help they need to get back on the feet themselves without a need for a check from Washington, D.C.? And I really want to point to the heartland governors and heartland states that are actually doing that, regardless of what we hear from the coasts.
He is Michael Hendricks, Director of State and Local Policy at the Manhattan Institute. Michael, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Good op-ed from Frank Mealy at RealClearPolitics.com, Confessions of a Trump Republican. He writes, Trump is not a leader in the traditional sense of inspiring his supporters to believe as he does, but rather someone who gains his strength and power from his ability to reflect the beliefs of those whom he leads. If you want to know why I'm a Trump Republican, and by the way, Mealy has been from the beginning, It's because only Trump has consistently and effectively put into words the values and beliefs I was armed with long before he appeared on the scene. The mistake that has been repeated throughout Trump's candidacy and presidency, overestimating Trump's persuasiveness and underestimating the savvy of his audience. It wasn't Trump who shaped the conservative movement in America, but rather the conservative movement that shaped Trump, like Pygmalion, into the political embodiment of heartland American values. Free speech, law and order, good jobs, secure borders, equality, and not equity. He goes on to essentially put an exclamation point on it, saying his genius was recognizing the spirit of the times and riding it into the White House. And if you want to know, he concludes, why I'm a dead-ender, a Trump Republican to the end, it's this. No one else will fight like hell for the country I grew up in, the country I believe in, and the country that my forefathers died for. Trump may not be perfect, neither am I, but he damn sure didn't have to hypnotize me or manipulate me or mislead me to get me on his side. I think that's a really important point that's lost in all the Trump analysis. To some extent, we don't start from the premise of the left in dismissing Trump supporters as unsophisticated rubes, credulous boomer rubes and deplorables, of course. But we perhaps don't make the point the way that Mealy did, that Trump came to the table to reflect a viewpoint and an authenticity in advance of that viewpoint that was absent. Thus, the market opportunity that was there and the opportunity that Donald Trump sees like perhaps no other could, particularly in 2016. Interesting. For more on this topic and that in the context of all that transpired over the weekend at CPAC, where she was there, we're pleased to be joined by Amber Athey. She's a Washington editor for The Spectator, senior Blankley Fellow at the Steamboat Institute, and host of Unfit to Print for The Daily Caller. Amber, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
What about Frank Mealy's observation there about sort of it was the Trump voters that helped to shape Trump, not the other way around? And this is something that the D.C. press corps has consistently missed because they consistently dismiss Trump voters.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. When I talked to family members of mine who supported Trump from the very beginning, the common refrain was he's talking about things that I've been thinking and haven't been able to say or express for such a long time. Things like, why are we still in war in Afghanistan? Why are we still agreeing to trade deals that are bad for the American manufacturer, bad for the American worker? Why are we allowing amnesty for all of these illegal immigrants who cross our border? And in some cases, turn out to be violent criminals. So when they saw Trump saying these things, it was refreshing. It wasn't that they had never heard this before. It was that they had never heard a politician say it before.
And another observation from CPAC, and get your take on this, because I think you're a little younger than this demographic, but I was talking to Scott McKay from The Hayride yesterday, and we're talking about two of the rising stars that were featured at CPAC, that are very much in Trump's orbit, but they're their own people as well, Governors Noem of South Dakota and DeSantis of Florida. And he said basically his observation was, this is Trump and Gen X Trump supporters that are now ascendant, that have essentially taken over the party, and they're probably, and that reality is probably best reflected in those two governors.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what was most important about those two governors is actually the message that they had to share. It wasn't just we support the president, but they were able to successfully reiterate these policies that we're talking about. DeSantis, for example, talked about immigration restriction. Governor Noem talked about not subjecting the residents of her state to these strict COVID lockdowns and instead championing personal responsibility and the choice of businesses to indicate whether or not they want to have a mask mandate or whether or not they want to shut down. And it's really the Trumpism that will outlast Trump, I think. If Trump decides not to go for the presidency in 2024, it's going to be the ideology that's more important than the loyalty. Obviously, supporting him is important to these people, but they also don't want to support someone who's blindly loyal to Trump without having that policy, that ideology background as well.
Back in February, Nikki Haley said Trump went down a path he shouldn't have with respect to the election challenges and what transpired on January 6th. But she changed her tune, saying she was impressed with Trump's speech at CPAC. What's your reaction to Nikki Haley's change of heart?
Well, she's the perfect example of what I was just talking about, right? She claims to support the president. She served in his administration. But when it comes down to it, on ideology, she's a neocon, and she wavers at every opportune moment. She doesn't have the backbone required to stand up for conservatives who for a long time felt like they're constantly ceding ground to the left, like their priorities were not spoken about unless they were politically popular until Trump came along. So Nikki Haley really represents a return to the type of sort of spineless, opportunistic Republican that used libertarian economics and warmongering foreign policy and tried to sell that to people who didn't have any better option.
Yeah, and she got caught, too, with the statement that she made in February that was just referenced. And now she's trying to get back in good graces that that moment has passed. And Trump is, I mean, perhaps more popular, at least within the wide swath of Republican ranks than he's ever been.
Yes, exactly. And when you look at the CPAC polling, it shows that Trump is still really popular, but he's not the end all be all for the party anymore because he had something like a 95% approval rate among the CPAC attendees, but only just over 50%, about 55% said that they would vote for him in the 2024 primary. And coming up closely behind him, of course, is Ron DeSantis. And when you take Trump out of that poll, Ron DeSantis gets about 46-47%. In the 2024 primary. So there's room for a lot of voices in the party. I think it's encouraging to see that there are quite a few leaders that are coming up out of the grassroots America and making their voices heard, because if Trumpism is going to be successful long term, it has to be more than just one guy.
And you have written about Florida recently over at The Spectator. You posit the question, why does anyone still live in the northeastern United States? Did you find out why that is? Because I don't know either.
Yeah, well, as someone who lives in D.C., I can tell you that I am strongly contemplating why I'm still here. I mean, most of it is for work, as I imagine a lot of people, you know, in D.C. and New York are as well. But I had such a great time in Florida, and not just because of the, you know, loose coronavirus restrictions and being able to sit at a bar without a mask and have a good time. But also there's just this culture there that's very non-judgy. Everyone does their own thing, and that's celebrated. The idea that you can go out and have a good time, you don't take yourself too seriously, you can make your own choices. It's just a culture of freedom that you really can't experience in the Northeast.
Amber Athey, Washington editor for The Spectator, senior Blankley fellow at the Steamboat Institute, and host of Unfit to Print for The Daily Caller. Amber, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show, and we return to the matter of K-12 education and providing a good example that you don't have to live the way that people are living in Chicago, New York, L.A., elsewhere, Oregon, where your kid is being prevented from accessing his school. You don't have to live that way. And this is not yet another story about South Dakota or Florida. It's actually a story about Iowa. And Iowa Republican Governor Kim Reynolds, she just recently signed a bill into law that requires every public and accredited private school in her state to offer in-person learning 5 days a week. Everyone. Every public, every accredited private in her state to offer in-person learning 5 days a week. She makes the comments you have heard and would expect to hear, kids falling behind, so on and so forth. But I think it was instructive, one Zoom call she observed that perhaps pushed her over the edge on this. At one meeting, according to the governor, a parent who's a professor at Iowa State University explained that she was teaching in person And she offered to walk her kids' school board through the mitigation measures the universities had put in place. And the response that the professor from Iowa State got? Go pound it. They said, if you want your child to be in the classroom, then you should just go buy a house in the neighboring district, according to Kim Reynolds. Now, how just unconscionable is that? Well, welcome to who's in control of your schools, and to the extent that you have any influence in the operation of your kids' schools, you can assess that by looking at whether or not your kid's school is open at all, or whether you need a governor to come in over the top like Kim Reynolds did. I mean, it's just remarkable, isn't it? Iowa State professor, well, here's how we're doing at Iowa State. So tell me again how we all want kids to be back in school, but we want it to be safe. What's happening at Iowa State, by the way, with older kids at the collegiate level and older professors, generally speaking, than the teachers at the K through 12 level. So thus, they are more exposed, still infinitesimally, unless they're over the age of 60 or 65, but more so than younger K through 12 teachers and younger K through 12 students. Doesn't matter. Don't want to hear it. They're so constructive. And then there's the hypocrisy, which abounds, because these teachers' union bosses and so many of these school board members and school administrators, at least those that are lockdown enthusiasts, are just like the politicians. The head of the California Teachers Union in Berkeley that dropped his kid off to in-person learning at her school while advocating for the schools to be shut down. I love sort of the rationalizations too. The superintendent in Alexandria City, Virginia, who has always been proud to call himself a parent of two children who attend public school, until he had to make a change. He pulled one of his kids from public school, which was remaining all virtual, to the frustration of many parents, apparently including him, and instead enrolled a child in a private Catholic high school currently following a hybrid model. I can confirm that our family made a decision to change my daughter's school this school year, said Alexandria City Public School Superintendent Gregory Hutchings. Decisions like these are very personal family decisions and are not taken lightly. This in no way impacts my absolute lifelong commitment to public education, to which I remain as personally dedicated as ever. Well, isn't that good to know, Superintendent Hutchings? That's so great. Superintendent Hutchings, who warned pod-based learning creates inequities. You know, parents getting together to educate their kids when you have schools that are just operating virtually. He wagged his finger at that. No. That creates inequities. But his daughter going to a Catholic school that's doing in-person education as opposed to the public school that wasn't, that doesn't create any inequities, or at least not any inequities he's concerned about. You know why? Because it's his daughter. And these are very personal decisions. I don't want to talk about my daughter. How dare you talk about my daughter? You know, like that routine too. How dare you talk about my children? How dare you film me dropping off my children? Oh, of course, these are private matters. This is my family. It's all very personal and private for me. You can't connect to what I do privately, you can't connect that, the decisions I make for my children, with the decisions I make for your children. It's a fascinating position he's taken. I don't know who buys that, but apparently some do. That's how you know how much control you have, where somebody like Superintendent Hutchings or the Berkeley Teachers Union boss, or that school board that told the Iowa State professor to go pound it. That's how you know just exactly what control you do not have over your child's education, how little those in control are interested in your viewpoint on your child's education, and how desperately you should want to get your child out of any school system in which those individuals are in decision-making positions. This is Dan Proft. It's a mistake.
Listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. Continuing on the topic of education, but getting specific here with STEM and even more specific with higher ed, although not limited to it. This very interesting op-ed from that was posted by Barry Weiss at her space on Substack. It's a guest op-ed from a Princeton University math professor named Sergei Kleinerman. He's Romanian. He writes, in my position as a professor of math at Princeton, I've witnessed the decline of universities and cultural institutions as they've embraced political ideology at the expense of rigorous scholarship. And then this statement, which is rather a remarkable one, considering what's been happening at the Ivy League in the Ivy League schools for some time. It's a remarkable statement he makes, but I understand he's focused on his work and trying to stay away from politics. It's hard. It's hard to ignore what's happening. But he writes, until recently, this past summer really, I had naively thought that the STEM disciplines would be spared from this ideological takeover. Particularly surprising surprise, considering he knows something about growing up under totalitarianism with Ceausescu's brand of communism in Romania, as if any space in society is spared. It isn't. He admits, I was wrong. Attempt to deconstruct mathematics, deny its objectivity, accuse it of racial bias, and infuse it with political ideology have become more and more common, perhaps even at your child's elementary school. Yes, now he's really waking up to what's happening. Unlike the this is a key, though, this comparison he makes between the traditional totalitarianism with which he is familiar to this cultural brand of totalitarianism that we see happening in all of the civic and cultural institutions in America. He writes, unlike the traditional totalitarianism practiced by former communist countries like the Romania I grew up in, this version, what he's experiencing now, what he sees in STEM, including math, this version is soft. It enforces its ideology not by jailing dissenters or physically eliminating them, but by socially shaming, mob punishment, guilt by association, and coerced speech. When it comes to education, I believe the woke ideology is even more harmful than old-fashioned communism. Just take that statement in for a minute, won't you? When it comes to education, I believe the woke ideology is even more harmful than old-fashioned communism. Princeton math professor said that. That's should be a jarring statement if it's not. He explained, being the logical mathematician he is, communism had a strong sense of objective reality anchored in the belief that humans are capable of discovering universal truths. It forcefully asserted, in fact, the absolute truth of dialectical materialism as revealed by its founders, Marx, Engels, and Lenin. With a little help from Hegel, I'd add. Communist ideology held science and mathematics in the highest regard, even though it often distorted the former for doctrinal reasons. Mathematics was largely immune to ideological pressure and thus thrived in most communist countries. He writes, being skilled in math was a source of great societal prestige for school children, and it was a great equalizer. Those from socioeconomically disadvantaged families had a chance to compete on equal footing with those from privileged ones. And he was drawn to math, and he was able to do just that. The woke ideology, on the other hand, treats both science and mathematics as social constructs and condemns the way they are practiced in research and teaching as manifestations of white supremacy, Eurocentrism, and postcolonialism. And guess who's promoting that, financing that woke ideology and the programs that follow? The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. There they are again. The program they're financing, Pathway to Equitable Math Instruction, argues white supremacy culture shows up in the classroom when the focus is on getting the right answer, or when students are required to show their work while stipulating that the very concept of mathematics being purely objective is unequivocally false. In the past, writes Professor, he would have dismissed such statements, ignored them. They're too radical. They don't need comment. But he writes, recent trends across the country suggest that we no longer have that luxury. Going back to something he said, too, about math being the great equalizer. Those from socioeconomically disadvantaged families had a chance to compete on equal footing with those from privileged ones. That folds in John McWhorter, another Ivy League professor, mentioned on the show before, linguistics professor at Columbia University, black American gentleman. And he tackles the question, is it racist to expect black kids to do math for real? And he references a document called Dismantling Racism in Mathematics Instruction, put together by educators, probably the same educators that just knocked half a dozen Dr. Seuss books out of publication. Mm-hmm. He writes of them, this lovely pamphlet is teaching us that it is racist to expect black kids to master the precision of math. To wit, its message, penned by people who consider themselves some of the most morally advanced souls in the history of the human species, is one that Strom Thurmond would have happily taken a swig of whiskey to. His overarching point that he makes quite bluntly and eloquently, because he is an eloquent rhetorician as well as writer. The entire document is focused on the idea that making black kids be precise is immoral. The thrust of the pamphlet is a focus on getting the right answers, perfectionism, and either-or thinking. The idea that teachers are teachers and students are learners is wrong. To think of a problem that the expectations you have for students are to think of it as a problem that the expectations you have for students are not met, that's racist. To teach math in a linear fashion with skills taught in sequence, that's racist. To require students to show their work, that's racist. To require students to raise their hand before speaking can reinforce paternalism and power hoarding, in addition to breaking the process of thinking, learning, and communicating. McWhorter writes, to distrust this document is not to be against social justice, but against racism. He says of this idea that black kids should not be expected to master the precision of math. This is bigotry right out of Reconstruction, Tulsa, Selma, and Charlottesville. This is Dan Proft.
Podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
Welcome back to the show. President Trump made election reform a central topic in his speech at CPAC on Sunday evening. And obviously this is a central topic of concern for conservatives and Trump voters throughout the country, what happened in those states that were determinative. So here's the first state to act in a material way to reform the way their state will administer elections going forward, Georgia. Georgia has sending legislation to Governor Brian Kemp's desk. I don't know if it'll put Kemp and Raffensperger, but particularly Kemp, back in good standing with Trump or not. But the proposal is a real improvement, there's no question. On the absentee ballots, under the legislation, voters must include their Georgia driver's license or ID number or a photocopy of another government-issued ID in order to request an absentee ballot. So this would do away with the signature match because you'd have the ID. Shortens the window for Georgians to request an absentee ballot by more than half, from 180 days prior to the election to 78 days before. And you have to submit your application within 11 days of the election so that you get turnaround time here in terms of getting the votes counted. The bill prohibits counties and states from sending out unsolicited ballot applications, as they did ahead of the 2020 primaries. This was something else that President Trump was talking about, sort of the indiscriminate mailing of applications and ultimately ballots. Counties would be required to have at least one absentee ballot drop box, but cannot have more than one per 100,000 active registered voters or number of advanced voting locations in the county, whichever is less. This addresses the whole Zucker boxes, these absentee ballot drop boxes. Not only limiting the number, but also the boxes would have to be at county elections offices or inside an advanced voting location, would only be open during early voting hours, and they would be under constant surveillance. Early voting would change slightly. It would still begin about 3 weeks before the election. The hours change slightly. The provisional ballots would be a thing of the past. Anyone who shows up at present to the wrong precinct can ask to cast a provisional ballot. That means the voter will likely end up with races on their ballot for which they're not qualified to vote. Under current law, election officials simply count the votes for the races in which the voter was qualified. This legislation would require they toss out the ballot entirely. You got to vote in your proper precinct. Also, the legislation requires ballots be printed on security paper so they can be identified as valid. Bans taking, counties taking grants or any other outside funding to run their elections for things like those drop boxes, i.e. Mark Zuckerberg's foundation. And the Secretary of State, that would be Brad Raffensperger, but the Secretary of State's office would be stripped of some power. Rather than serving as the chairman of the state election board, the Secretary of State would instead just be a non-voting member. The legislature would choose their own chair to head up the board. So, again, this is not the end-all, be-all. Every state is going to be different. They have different challenges they have to address based on their performance in November of last year. But this is Georgia addressing their issues in a material way. And Georgia, remember, this is not a state that the Democrats are just going to abandon because they got two senators elected. And, oh, by the way, Ralph Warnock, one of those senators, is up for re-election in 22, and that the outcome of that election could determine, here we go again, the balance of power, the control of the Senate. And so it's important that these reforms are advanced, that Kemp signs them into law, and that Republicans are doing the prep work in advance of 2022 right now. So Georgia seems to be getting a jump on it, and that's the good news. Hopefully states will do likewise. This is Dan Proft.
This is the Dan Proft Show. The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. And Joe Biden famously said that we need to keep spending to keep from going bankrupt. That was talking about funny money spending after the Great Recession of 2008-2009 in the first term of the Obama-Biden administration, the Joe-Bama administration. They're in their third term now, if you're counting at home. And now he's suggesting the same. And more specifically, that we need to spend $2 trillion of government funny money to get America back to work. Well, Casey Mulligan has crunched some of the numbers, and he suggests actually that $2 trillion spend would have the opposite effect of getting Americans back to work. Casey Mulligan's a professor of economics at the University of Chicago. He served as the chief economist of the White House Council of Economic Advisors in 2018 and 19. And he's the author of You're Hired, Untold Successes and Failures of a Populist President. Casey, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
You're glad to be back, Dan.
Wait a second. So we're going to spend more money that we're going to be protecting people's jobs, and we're going to be just giving them some bridge money for those who've been displaced or underemployed during the pandemic so they can get back to work, get full-time employment. That's the plan. That's at least part of the sales pitch. Why won't that come to pass if this legislation passes and is enacted?
Well, it's a dismal science that tells us there are trade-offs. You give relief to people in tough situations, that's relief. But it also will increase the number of people in tough situations. And this so-called stimulus does it in ways we've never seen before. When Obama did his stimulus 12 years ago, he had, for example, a $25 a week bonus for the unemployed. But now we're talking $400 bonus. So many, many times bigger than ever been tried before, other than what was done briefly with the CARES Act.
Well, the $400 bonus, then, that's just to smooth out this difficult time. What's wrong with $400 as opposed to 25 or 100 or 200?
It does smooth out the difficult time, but it also makes the difficult times last longer. When you subsidize something, you get more of it. And it comes in two directions. There'll be people who won't be in a hurry to get back to work because it's been smoothed over like this. Also, think of it from a business's perspective. They have to compete. Not only have to compete with the other businesses for workers, but now they're going to have to compete with the federal program, and some of the businesses will go out of business and won't be hiring people because of that.
And you say the Biden plan is welfare reform in reverse. What do you mean?
Yeah, the idea came about in the 90s. It was heavily debated in the Clinton years. Should people getting government benefits be required to work? And the Democrats at the time said, go ahead and require them, but there's no jobs for them. And it went through. Gingrich and his Congress pushed it through. And everybody was surprised. And even Obama himself acknowledged years later, you know, I was wrong about that welfare reform. It really does work, no pun intended. But I guess that lesson's been forgotten. And so we're taking away the requirements to work when on government benefits.
You make some important points that people need to keep in mind. For example, the benefits being conferred, the transfer payments, are largely received tax-free. And so there's the actual amount that is being reported, and then, you know, there's the take-home amount as compared to what would be required to get that same take-home amount if you were working and subject to payroll tax, for example. So, I mean, you look at the number, and then you have to layer on the taxation that gives you the real sort of benefit that's being conferred.
That's right. And that strategy started in the Obama stimulus as well. They tried to push as much money through the untaxed programs as they could. And that, like you said, that further puts the thumb on the scale in favor of not working, staying out of work longer, retiring earlier, those sort of things.
You write in this piece in the journal that you wrote that I'm referencing, I mean, these are numbers that are going to stun people. In Kansas, a family of four with two unemployed adults who has earned U.S. median wages, so median wages, so was maybe household income, 55 grand, something like that, including the Biden add-on package, the after-tax equivalent of more than $135,000 on an annual basis without working an hour. That would be the value of it. In Massachusetts, it's 170 grand. You're making 55. You go on the, you know, Biden transfer payment program, and you're getting the equivalent of 135 grand, almost three times your income, without having to do anything. Well, who wouldn't opt for that?
Yeah, well, there'll be some people who won't. They really do want to get back to work, but there will be millions of people who do opt for that, and that's why this is this relief package is the opposite of a stimulus.
Right, sure. I mean, you know, one of the things, it's a short term infusion, and people make economic decisions in the long term. But as you said, for the short term, you know, I don't need to rush back to work unless perhaps it would imperil my long term employment prospects. But if it doesn't, why not just sit it out and enjoy that sort of win? I mean, it's really a windfall, isn't it?
Yeah, for groups of people who are in that situation. It's the sort of thing they've never seen before.
And so for it's that now pulling back and giving sort of a macro impact of this, with sort of these dynamics at play, what are we looking at in terms of the employment impact of this $2 trillion spend?
We think it's going to be 5 to 7 million jobs. We know where we were.
5 to 7 million jobs lost.
Yeah, we know where we were before the pandemic, and we like to get back to that and then pass it up. But this will keep us 5 or 7 million below where we were.
So it's not necessarily adding to, but it's restraining from getting back to that pre-pandemic place of employment.
Yeah, and the Obama days will come back again. Remember, the Obama people were scratching their heads. Why aren't we having a recovery? Why aren't we having a recovery? Well, that sort of head scratching is about to start in Washington again, because you can't have a recovery under those sort of incentives.
On a related story, you didn't write about this, but just you're an economist, you can tackle this. The larger macro concerns you have about this continued printing press and spending of money that we're manufacturing out of thin air. And the implications for that, as we try to unwind from not just a decade of modern monetary theory, but also then this last year of substantial shutdowns of the economy.
Well, my focus always is what they spend it on. Money well spent, I think, can be borrowed. But the big concern is what they're spending on, and a lot of counterproductive spending going on here, going to special interests that only enhance the power and entrench those kind of unhealthy situations.
Well, give us an example then so people can distinguish it from the rhetoric you hear from politicians like Nancy Pelosi who say unemployment insurance is stimulative. Give us an idea of what you think is positive spend in a situation like this, or generally speaking, that has a real discernible return on investment as opposed to just the politician that says, you know, every dollar we spend has a positive ROI.
Anything with the vaccine once people have had that vaccine and the virus isn't spreading anymore in our communities, then you have the backdrop to be back to normal. And anything the government can do, you know, get those vaccine places working 24/7, you know, it wouldn't take a lot of money. And like you said, it'd be a huge ROI. We've already had a huge ROI on their Operation Warp Speed, which is only a $10 billion program, and just a sliver of what this relief package is. But it's made a much more noticeable difference than any policy that's been done anywhere in the world.
He is Casey Mulligan, who, along with his colleague Steve Moore, wrote to this piece about the job impact of the $1.9 trillion Biden proposal. He's a professor of economics at the University of Chicago, who served as the chief economist of the White House Council of Economic Advisors in 2018 and 19. And he's the author of You're Hired, Untold Successes and Failures of a Populist President. Casey, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Dan.
Take care.
And sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. You can knock Mitt Romney down, apparently, but he keeps getting back up as long as there's money to spend, other people's, that is. Romney sporting a shiner yesterday in D.C. Thank goodness he had that life alert so that he could get help when he falls. Romney has been one of the lead compromisers to the $1.9 trillion in funny money spending proposed and now making its way through Congress by the Biden administration. And as we've talked about on this show before, perhaps as he described himself representing a tiny wing of the Republican Party, perhaps that wing is so tiny because he takes the premise of the left when it comes to policy and just says, let's only do 50% of what you want to do or 25% of what you want to do, rather than trying to advance any percent of something that conservatives should be desirous of doing. And it also speaks to the compromise proposals, not just including Romney, but including Tom Cotton on the minimum wage, for example. It speaks to a topic that's covered by our next guest in a recent piece in National Review. The conservative fight over the size of government, and the size of government clearly implicates spending, government spending, state spending, your tax dollars at work or not. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Sam Gregg, who's the research director for the Acton Institute. Sam, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. It's good to be with you.
In addition to some plaudits Romney and other Republican senators are getting for being willing to deal on another COVID-19 round of relief spending, where some conservatives think the number should be zero. He's getting high marks in places like The New Yorker for his proposal on child care benefits for families, taxpayer-financed child care benefits for families. And you wrote about that, used that as the example to sort of distill this debate going on within conservative and Republican ranks over spending.
Yes, I mean, it's very clear the Romney proposal underscores that there's a growing division about the role of government in not just the economy, but society more generally, between, on the one hand, social conservatives and those who consider themselves fiscal conservatives. So, for example, many social conservatives praise the Romney initiative. They said, at last, finally, someone is taking our concerns about what's happening to the family seriously, and this is someone who's proposing direct support to families. Many fiscal conservatives reacted, however, by saying, no, we are in a process of growing the federal budget even more. Conservatives should not be in the business of increasing public spending at a time when we're heavily in debt and we're relying upon debt to get us through. So that, and of course, people who are both social and fiscal conservatives found themselves in a position where they're being asked to choose, right? They're being asked to choose, do you support the family or not? Or do you support the market economy? So the Romney proposal, even though it amounted to effectively $66 billion in extra spending, which lamentably is small change by federal government spending standards, even though the amount of money involved was relatively small, what it did do was highlight this growing fracture among conservatives, which is reflected in the Republican Party, about these types of issues. What is the role of government in society and in the economy? And I don't see this issue being resolved anytime soon, frankly, because I think that people are starting to dig themselves into positions about these issues, but also because there is a genuine crisis confronting the family in America, but there's also a genuine economic and fiscal crisis confronting America. And when people are faced with crises, they often ask us to make choices about what we think is really important. So these divisions, I'm afraid, are going to exist in the conservative movement for a while. It's not quite clear to me yet how these things are resolved.
Well, the problem, even if you take the position of, say, a Lyman Stone at the American Enterprise Institute, that the Romney proposal has some solid features, and then in the sense that it is even-handed. It's not sort of picking winners and losers when it comes to family support. It's uniform in that way. So if you want to do a child care tax credit, then that, you know, this is the way to do it. The problem even with that position, though, is it puts you in a bit of a trick bag. So, for example, this is something else from the $1.9 trillion the Biden administration has proposed that hasn't got talked about by many Republicans, unfortunately, but there's a new $120 billion welfare program in the bill. I mean, SNAP and food stamps is about a $65 billion program. This doubles it, just about. And we're not talking about that, but if you start to say, well, you want to do tax credit for stable families for their child care, but you don't want to spend to provide food and other benefits to families that are struggling, single moms and so on and so forth. And then you get right into this tit for tat where if you want to spend right your $65 billion, then you got to spend at least my $65 billion over here.
Exactly. I mean, these are some of the problems when you start to examine the Romney proposal. So, for example, you pointed out they're basically saying, well, we're going to be giving money across the board to families, full stop, we know, quote unquote, picking winners or losers. Well, we have no guarantee about how people will spend that money. There's no way of knowing that people will use this money to do what it's designed to do, which is support children. So that's one thing. The second problem, which is a variation on something you mentioned, the amounts being proposed are, I think, $350 for children below the age of 5 and $250 between the ages of 6 and, I think, 18. Okay, fine. Why not $1,000? And in other words, where's the limit? Thirdly, the other thing I think that's worth considering, which social conservatives should be just as concerned about as fiscal conservatives, is do we really want the federal government to be providing people with direct income? Do we really want that to be part of how people start to think about the way they think about how they earn income and how they spend money? The fact that the federal government is actually putting money directly into your account for these sorts of things, I think, should concern social and fiscal conservatives, both for reasons of fiscal prudence, but also the idea that this reflects this sort of ongoing temptation to look to the federal government to fix our problem. And some of the problems that many families are struggling with, some of them are economic, but many of them are social and cultural and cannot be fixed simply by spending money.
Well, right. And you're right to ask the question of principle first. Is this an area for the federal government? And then to the extent that there's agreement that it is, and I'm not saying there is, but to the extent there's agreement that it is, then how do these numbers that you come up with, where is the evidentiary backup that this makes a material right difference in the outcome for the children or the families?
Right.
Rather than just being arbitrary.
No, exactly. That's another point, because there's actually evidence, both empirical evidence but historical evidence, to suggest that these programs have, at best, a mixed record of success. And remember, we've tried some of these things before. We tried this in the New Deal. We tried this in the Great Society. And guess what? Some of those programs are still around. There's no particular evidence that they've made substantive changes to the communities they were designed to help. In fact, there's evidence that they have significantly contributed to damagings. The other thing we know is that these types of allowances, they haven't shifted the needle when it comes to things like increasing the birth rate or helping people to deal with some of the financial and social challenges that they face on a daily basis. On an evidentiary basis, there are questions that not just fiscal conservatives, but social conservatives should be asking about these sorts of things, but which they're presently not.
I want to pick up this conversation on the other side of the break on this topic that has been written about a lot recently. I mentioned Lyman Stone at the American Enterprise Institute, also Ross Douthat at the New York Times, the problem of Americans not having as many kids as the government says they need to have, so we have replacement rate, but not having as many kids as they actually want, according to survey research, and if that's really a public policy problem or a personal problem, as it were. More with Sam Gregg, research director at the Acton Institute, right after this.
Political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
We're back with Sam Gregg. He's the research director of the Acton Institute, and we're talking about his piece, The Conservative Fight Over the Size of Government, in particular with respect to the $1.9 trillion in COVID relief spend that has been proposed in combination with some of the compromises advanced by Republicans like Mitt Romney and proposals for child care tax credits advanced by Republicans like Mitt Romney again. And Sam, I wanted to get your reaction to the impetus from some social conservatives to see these child care tax credits, the Romney plan or others, as a positive development, even the checks that have been distributed with a bump based on the number of children you have during the pandemic, some conservatives, Republicans see as a positive. And the survey research that suggests that American families, American women, are not having as many children as they otherwise want to have. And that is not a one-variable equation to solve, but that's the bottom line takeaway. They're not having as many children as they want, and there are some reasons for this, including financial reasons. And one of the ways some social conservatives would argue is that you can remove some of the barriers for families to have as many children as they want, which would be to the good of America as a whole, is to provide these child care tax credits or something akin to that, so that there is not as much financial pressure when it comes to having a bigger family. And the response to that argument is what?
Right. Well, we have child tax credits in place already. They already exist, and they've been around for a while, and they allow you to reduce your taxes depending upon how many children you have. They already exist. So if they were going to be having some sort of effect on the birth rate, one would assume that they would have done so by now. Of course, what the Romney plan is proposing is sort of direct payments. So there's a couple of things to think about here. One, we do know that one effect of such policy is to increase the number of single mothers. There's plenty of empirical evidence that points to that. And one has to ask oneself, is that a good thing for America? Is that a good thing for society? Is that good for the economy? Is that good for America as a whole? I think a lot of people would say that is not optimal. And is it really the case that we should be using federal money to effectively incentivize people to think that way? So that's a problem. I mean, I'm all in favor of big families, but it does seem to me that while there is evidence that economic pressures can cause people to think about, well, are they going to have two or three children or three or four children? There's no question, I think, that economics plays a role as people reflect on those sorts of issues. But we also know that tax credits have not shifted the needle, and there's not strong evidence either way, I think, that child allowances will make much difference either. I mean, this is the other thing we need to think about, right, with economic policy. Economics teaches us to watch out for things like unintended consequences. So on the one hand, it may well be that these child allowances don't shift the needle when it comes to the overall birth rate, but they may well increase the number of single mothers in the United States. So this is a classic example where a policy designed to achieve one objective probably won't achieve the objective that's designed, and yet there's also significant evidence that such a policy would actually realize or help create the type of social and familial dynamics that social conservatives, in fact, anyone, should have some serious concerns about.
Yeah, and again, to your point on the Romney plan, I misspoke about it being a direct payment different than a tax credit. And this, you know, really is precedent setting with all sorts of other proposals out there, mainly from the left, for the government to be directly paying people to do this or to not do this,
right,
or to not do that, and universal basic income, and you really start to potentially open the floodgates there.
Right. I mean, UBI is a classic example of this, right? Because we hear, it's a similar type of argument that this is how the federal government can directly help people in need in a time of and a changing economy that's changing because of technology, because of comparative advantage, working out in different ways, et cetera, et cetera. But one thing that UBI does do, and we know this, is that it disencourages people to work. And that is a problem. That's a real problem. And in fact, we also know that in those countries, some countries which have tried UBI, like Finland, for example, they tried it for a year and then they stopped. And they stopped because they could see that it was discouraging people from working. And work is, as we all know, not just something that's economically good. Work is something that's socially, culturally, and I would even argue morally good for people to undertake. So disincentivizing people to work in order to give them this universal basic income. Social conservatives and fiscal conservatives have good reason to be concerned about government going down that path. But I think it also illustrates your broader point. Once the government gets into the business of directly providing benefits in all sorts of ways to individuals beyond the ways it already does, the floodgates are very difficult to close after that. Once these things get into legislation, getting them out of legislation becomes harder and harder.
He is Sam Gregg, Research Director at the Acton Institute. Sam, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, and another provision in the $1.9 trillion of government funny money that the Biden administration and the Democrat Socialists in Congress want to spend for years to come under the guise of COVID relief, under the guise of stimulus, under the guise of anything other than what it is, which is a way to foment dependency and curry favor for political reasons. One provision in there, you'll like this. This from the Cut Me In or Cut It Out. A provision, it would enable a new Treasury Department fund called the Emergency Federal Employee Leave Fund to pay federal employees up to $1,400 a week for 15 weeks as paid time off, so $21,000 over 15 weeks, if they have kids who are not enrolled in full-time classroom instruction. Under the bill as currently drafted, full-time federal employees can take up to 600 hours in paid leave until September 30th, up to $35 an hour and $1,400 a week. That's 15 weeks for a 40-hour employee. Part-time and seasonal employees are eligible, too, with equivalent hours established by their agency. It's just remarkable. On the one hand, so, you know, the unions, public sector, looking out for, and the Democrat Socialist Party that they control, looking out for the public sector. The public sector looking out for the public sector at the expense of the private sector. So you can, you know, you got a problem with this just being remote learning because the public sector union called the teachers union doesn't want to reopen your kid's school. How about this? How about we pay you to stay home and you can hang out with your kid while we Zoom learn? How's that sound? Oh, and by the way, we'll make you know, those not cut in on the deal pay for it all. Getting fleeced by a government you finance and getting very little in return. That is the calling card of the political ruling class. And this is just another 600 pages more of that sort of thing, isn't it? And you see it at the local level, too. It's not just the hypocrisy. It's the pay, the full pay for no work. In Chicago, where I live, as you know, if you listen to this show, schools have been closed. But in Chicago, because it's so dangerous, the city in their infinite wisdom created these safe passage jobs for people in yellow fluorescent flak jackets to walk the kids to school across, particularly when they have to walk across different gang territory. Now, these safe passage escorts are unarmed, but they do provide, you know, I guess, an adult accompaniment. Well, Chicago schools have been closed until this week for a year. But safe passage workers were still paid $4.3 million in tax, $4.3 million in tax dollars this year to man street corners. To man street corners where there are no kids because there's no school. Hey, but everybody's got to get paid. Everybody who's been cut in gets theirs. Oh, and you get yours too. They get the cash, you get the bill. See how that works? What's also on the horizon, telegraphed by what's included in this, same thing, $1.9 trillion, Biden. Andy Biggs writes about this over in the Wall Street Journal, prelude to a state pension bailout. What's included in the Biden gambit here is bailout of private sector multi-employer pension funds that are underfunded. And Andy Biggs, who's written extensively on the topic of public sector pensions and the implications of $4 trillion in unfunded liabilities, I think most of which reside in Illinois. But he asks, if politicians will bail out truckers and coal miners' pensions, why would they turn away teachers and firefighters? So here again, are you cut in? Are you a big blue state? If you're not, even if you're a purple state that's got a fully funded pension system, like, say, Wisconsin, get ready to get yours, meaning bills. You're going to be underwriting the bailouts of states where the public sector union workers, who these states exist to finance, I'm talking about states like Illinois, like New York and California and Connecticut, that have wildly underfunded pension liabilities, who are going to see municipal and perhaps in the not too distant future state pension funds fail. Get ready to see the precedent be set with the Biden bailout here for future bailouts elsewhere, depending on, of course, who is controlling the levers of power in D.C. Biggs goes into it. Today, more than 100 multi-employer pensions face critical and declining funding, according to the Pension Guarantee Corporation. One of the biggest central states portfolio expected to run dry in 2025, with other plans to follow. Ordinarily, insolvency means pension freezes and benefit reductions, but multi-employer pensions are run by labor unions, key Democrat constituency. And so the House COVID bill plans to dole out an estimated $86 billion over the next 4 years, 3 years. This is emergency COVID relief? Right. $86 billion over the next 3 years to 186 pensions, enabling these plans to pay full benefits through 2051. With no incentive to cut costs, there's little reason to think the pensions will be solvent after 2051. Look forward to more spending down the road. But even more important, look forward to more spending in the near term if this same cadre of socialists retains power to bail out public sector pension funds that are going to go belly up even well before some of these multi-employer pension funds that are in danger right now. This is Dan Proft. Another one bites the dust.
DanProfShow.com.
Welcome back to the show. To close out today, since we've talked so much about the purge, how about some positive news? Don't want to just focus on cursing the Jacobins. Let's also focus on who's taking up the fight. Larry Sanger is a co-founder of Wikipedia, and he is launching a new project because he recognizes that his the site that he co-founded has become nothing more than another outlet for left-wing propaganda. He is launching a competing website as a free speech-friendly alternative to what he views as the monolithic left-wing tilt of his former organization. The forthcoming project, called Encyclosphere, is a decentralized network of the world's encyclopedias, what he called an old-fashioned, leaderless, ownerless network like the blogosphere. He said, just as there are no administrators in the blogosphere, in the same way, I want to create a protocol that very loosely ties all the encyclopedias online together. And I guess the propagandizing in the descriptions in Wikipedia entries of communism and socialism put Larry Sanger over the edge and motivated him to create this encyclosphere, which we look forward to. Another story of fighting back against the purge, what is bien pensant in sports. This is a small college, small Division III college, Bluefield College, Baptist Liberal Arts School, nestled in the Appalachian Mountains in Bluefield, Virginia. It's a reminder that not all of Virginia is Northern Virginia. Forfeited a basketball game. Why did it forfeit? Suspended its players. Why did it suspend its players? They violated the policy. What was the policy? Kneeling during the anthem. When players on the men's basketball team took a knee during the playing of the national anthem, after being warned several times it was against school policy, the school president promptly suspended players and forfeited the game. They had knelt several times before games in January and February, both home and away contests, and were warned about it. They decided to stay in the locker room, but before the game on February 9, the players decided to kneel for the anthem. College president David Olive told the coach there would be consequences for the actions of the players for violating the college policy, and that's what he And that was the consequence that he visited upon them, suspension and thus forfeiture. It'd be interesting to see if he stands his ground on this. And one of the players, it's bigger than us, and we don't want to have the season taken away from us. We feel like we're in a great position to bring the school a title, so we'll stay in the locker room during the national anthem. They don't want any more backlash, and we would definitely take a knee during the anthem. Mm-hmm. The same player complained about a Trump rally that occurred near the college, but it's not okay for us to kneel for our people who've fallen. It'd be interesting to explore Stanley Christian, a forward on the team, his description of who those people are and how they've fallen. Mm-hmm. By the way, the Trump rally was not on the college grounds. The school had no connection with it, so it's a terrible comparison, which perhaps means that a forward Stanley Christian needs to spend a little bit more time in the classroom. So we'll see. David Olive, Bluefield College, will he hold fast against a basketball team that is upset with him for not being able to make a spectacle of themselves like children while representing Bluefield College? Thanks for joining us on another edition of the Dan Prof Show. Please do so again tomorrow and stay informed, so you can act courageously and we can live freely. Thanks for being with us.
This is the Dan Prof Show.